great pleasure in calling on Professor McCord Wright to speak next.
After a good deal of thought, I decided I would follow the prescription of a well-known American popular song and accentuate the positive. You all have my paper, and you know the problems of the Latin tradition, how Caesarism helps to prepare the way for the dictator, how the Aristotelian just price is easily twisted into the labor theory of value, and the identification of the aqueduct and that sort of thing with social progress. But I don't think that it is necessary to elaborate on that. Instead, I have said so much about how we ought to be more effective in what we are saying, I thought it was up to me to give some idea of what precisely I thought we ought to say. And so, if you don't mind, I'm going to run over the 8 requirements of economic growth as I give them in my lectures and in my book, because I do think that these very fundamental, simple, concrete facts are the things that, as far as I'm concerned, we ought to be stressing. So if I sound a bit pedantic, I hope you will forgive me. I start off with labor, natural resources, and education. And there is usually no argument about that, except that the very first thing which I have to say to my students is that natural resources are not natural. A great many of my students seem to have the idea that some nations are predestined to poverty because they don't have natural resources, and other nations are predestined to wealth because they do have natural resources. And it is necessary to point out that, for example, the United Kingdom is, relatively speaking, quite poor in natural resources. What it's got is an excellently trained labor force and an ideology, and so on. And that, for example, Norway, while not a very rich country, is in the hierarchy of world countries quite wealthy, relatively speaking, and it has very few natural resources. It took to the sea instead. So that to a very considerable extent, a country makes its natural resources. There's no cosmic predestination to poverty or riches from geography. It is much more a question of the attitude of the people toward life. All right. Labor, natural resources, education. The war starts when you mention the next requirement, which is saving. There I try to avoid labels as much as possible, and merely to point out that mankind is a tool-using animal, that without piling up a collection of efficient tools, the standard of living of the masses could not possibly be raised. And that in order to get the resources to build tools, you have to take some of the labor that otherwise might be used in going to the races or drinking wine, keeping it down on that very practical level. I may say this is hard work in Canada, because when I first got there, one of my colleagues said, I have a student who thinks that saving and investment are equal, and therefore they're the same thing. And that therefore, all you have to do if you want more saving is to do more investing. Can you break it? Well, I did, but it took me an hour and a half. That idea, that simple idea of muddle-headed Keynesianism, has sunk so deeply into the Canadian mind. It was very hard. This is a very brilliant, quite famous young man now, since then. But he was convinced that they were the same thing because Keynes said so. So you have to keep it down to very elementary level. You need more machines. To get more machines, you can't put all your energy into amusement. All right. But now comes the crucial point. Growth does not
income merely through more machinery. The law of diminishing returns applies to capital just as much as anything else. It is new type machinery. Marx's greatest fallacy is the assumption that capital is merely canned labor. The most important single thing that one has to realize is that capital is also, in a growing progressive society, the embodiment of the new idea. It must be treated not as an accumulation of past resources, but merely as the embodiment of a new constructive combination of resources. Now, this is where the trouble comes in. Because in order to get these resources recombined, there have to be certain qualities of personality and energy. Otherwise, the new idea will not take place. Now, that takes me into the next step, which is ideology. To have the enterprise of work, there must be an appropriate ideology. This ideology runs strongly counter to many supposedly right-wing ideas. The reason is this, that as you introduce these new methods through these new machines, you inevitably disturb the work structure. Growth comes through change and causes change. The idea of the nation governed from the parish pump, or governed from the small syndicate, with intimacy and contact, is unfortunately completely incompatible with the notion of economic development, which has led one very celebrated American psychologist to say that we were guilty of the corporate sin of believing in economic growth, because he, with a very naive determinism from my point of view, thinks that people are rendered mentally ill by being disturbed in their routine of life. This is a research professor at the University of Illinois, the past president of the American Psychological Association. The corporate sin of believing in economic growth, because at least he was clear-headed enough to know that economic growth did involve disturbance. Lord Lindsay of Birka, a labor man, but still in many ways a great thinker, also pointed out this thing. Legislation for us is not the same thing as legislation by us. There cannot be a society in which little independent organizations, intimately connected, not centrally planned, not managed by the pricing system, nevertheless make economic growth. Growth involves change. It has to be tied together and coordinated somehow, either through the pricing system, which I take it is what we believe, or else through a central planning board. But in either way, there is essentially involved some disturbance, some breaking up of intimate groups. Consequently, the tribal attitude won't wash if industrialism is what we want. I wrote a short article in the Chicago Business Review, Community Mobility Security, in which I pointed out that we did not solve the problem of the primitive nations, primitive tribes, by making a member of another tribe, by just taking him and putting him in a new business and settling him around a plant settlement. And he only became a free man, a mill village, as we call them at home. And he only became a free man when he was able to move from village to village, from plant to plant, from employment to employment. Because the ability to cope with and adapt to continual change is one of the necessary qualities of the citizen in a growing society. Now, it used to be taught when I was in college back in prehistoric times that if every man had equal money income and all industry was owned by the state, that there would be no pressure groups and no resistance to change. That's based on a one-eyed materialism of purely economic thinking. There are, unfortunately, many other aspects to a man's life besides the size of his paycheck. Love of friends, places, power, skills, several others. As you move a man, say, suppose a man is told that he must move from Paris to Avignon, and he likes Paris, the mere fact that his paycheck is undisturbed will scarcely make him any happier. Of course, if he likes Avignon and is told to go to Paris, the same thing is true. If you tell an English worker that if he goes to America, he will be better off paycheck-wise, he will probably laugh at you because he likes jolly old England. All right, more power to him. I only want to point out, though, that it is the disturbance of all these other motives which is most important, and that you cannot get a completely undisturbed society of pure intimacy and all that if you want industrialism. So we need to train people to the ideology which we need is one which permits spontaneous change and teaches people to adapt to spontaneous change, not to create new tribes or new static institutions. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Professor McCord Wright.